people like yourself and Peter Usher, we've been able to, I think, in the Canadian North, demonstrate to the larger Canadian public that it does in fact exist. We've done tremendous work in terms of documenting extensive land use and occupancy studies throughout Northern Canada. And so there is no longer an argument from our perspective as to the viability and to the effectiveness of our subsistence cultures. And it's also very important for us to be here from an educational sense. There is an awful lot that is occurring now within this state that has a direct bearing on our part of the world. We are involved in the process of attempting to establish agreements, contractual agreements with the governments of Canada with respect to the question of Aboriginal rights. You've had the experience in this part of the world of having to live with such an agreement for 13 years. And so many of the issues that you're talking about here today that we're addressing at this particular meeting are issues that we are being asked to come to a legal contractual arrangement on with the federal government of Canada. So it is a very important place for us to be right now to learn and hopefully to be able to take the knowledge that we acquire here and institute arrangements that are going to be of benefit to us. I think that in describing the Yukon situation with respect to the question of negotiations, it should be pointed out at the outset that we do not enjoy the situation of the Aboriginal people in the Northwest Territories, inasmuch as that we are not the majority of the population. Depending on your definition of what constitutes citizenship, we are anywhere from 30% of the present population to, in our opinion, 75% of the permanent population. And so we don't have at our disposal the kind of political leverage that is exercised in Northwest Territories. And as you will see in terms of discussions of the agreements and principles that we've signed to date, those agreements reflect that political reality. The particular points of history that relate to the Yukon claim are that the claim was formally adopted in 1973. Prior to 1973, it was Canadian government policy that Aboriginal rights did not really exist in the country. Following the Calder case, which involved the Nisga'a people from the Nass Valley, government changed their mind and instituted a process of negotiations to specifically define what Aboriginal rights really were and what they looked like. In 1973, our people presented to the federal government of Canada a position paper called Together Today for Our Children Tomorrow. That document formed the basis of which we wanted to proceed with negotiations with the federal government. Negotiations have been going on since that time. For many reasons, and we don't have the time to elaborate specifically, they had never concluded to either an agreement, and full agreement in principle, or obviously following to a final agreement in principle. And it's also, I think, beneficial to understand the political situation in Canada. It is very much different from the political situation in the United States. I don't profess any great knowledge as to the intricate historical relationships between Aboriginal peoples in the United States and the governments of the United States, but at the present time in Canada, we have a clear constitutional expression of the protection of Aboriginal rights. We've just gone through the onerous and difficult process of patriating our Constitution, and that Constitution clearly states that Aboriginal rights are recognized and affirmed.
That the harvest level should be as low as they are. Is that a concern of your people?
It is a concern, there's no question about that. Generally, the focus of resource development has been in the interest of the non-renewable resource area. And generally what happens is that the renewable resources suffer from that. Therefore, there's a real, it affects our people in terms of subsistence requirements there. Pressures by the managers to cut back in that area. But those kind of things would have to be considered in the future. If development is going to take place in a certain area, it would have to be subject to a very strict environmental screening process, taking consideration our interest in hunting, fishing, and trapping, and the social, economic, and the political structures of our people in reference to that project. So I guess through that process, it would be, the project would be evaluated, first of all, whether it's in that community's interest to go ahead with that project, whether it's going to benefit the community, the impacts on the livelihood towards subsistence would have to be weighed, and proper measures or mitigative measures would have to be considered if a project is allowed to go ahead. For instance, there is a proposal in the north slope of the Yukon to develop a rock quarry. It would have to go through this screening process, and ultimately at the end they would provide recommendation to the government whether the project should go ahead, taking consideration the subsistence. Those kind of things would have to be recommended to government along with the terms and conditions that would have to be placed on the project.
Dave Porter, you wanted to add something?
In the present laws that exist in Yukon today, Yukon government has no ability to affect the subsistence rights of Aboriginal people that are status Indian people. We can hunt anywhere in Yukon any time of the year, take any species of game. They can't initiate any legislative action that can curtail that activity. Under these agreements, that has given up. What has happened is that we've agreed to a 50% quota with respect to moose and caribou. They cannot, under this agreement, affect that quota except for measures of conservation, very much like the Inuvialuit Agreement. With respect to the current position of communities, there is dissatisfaction with the present agreement at the present time. That is why the ratification process of these agreements has been held up. What the dissenting communities are saying is that there should be a very clear stated position of the priority of the subsistence use of the resources in law. That is an element that they see missing here, and what they say is that these agreements should be restructured to say that subsistence use of the resources should be the absolute priority.
Dave, you mentioned status Indians who had the subsistence right at the present time under existing law, and the non-status Indians who have no subsistence rights. What's the proportion of status to non-status Indians in the Yukon? You said there are 6,000 altogether.
This is a very ugly blemish on Canadian history with respect to law as it relates to Aboriginal people in our country. They've purposely divided our people, and this has had tremendous impact all over Canada. And the division is still there very clearly in law, and then has translated itself into political division that has been monopolized and used by various governments for their own political interests. And we have situations where brothers and sisters sit on either side of the legal fence with respect to definition of who is who. And in the Yukon, fortunately, we've been able to politically live with that reality and have come to grips with it, and we're the only part of Canada that has thrown those artificial definitions out and have been able to conduct ourselves collectively. We've said we know who we are.
Center-fired cartridges. Each walrus hunting boat must have two harpoons with lines and float. Every boat is encouraged to have a functional walkie-talkie for safety purposes. Other suggested equipment for safety of all concerned are extra motor, oars, paddles, and at best 30 gallons of fuel, gas stove, spark plugs, flares, life jackets, blankets, extra food. And the thing on a limiting caliber, in 1978-1979, when the state of Alaska had management, the staff of the Fish and Game proposed to the game boards to limit the harvest of walrus to those calibers of rifle that were 264 Magnum and over. The reasoning behind the staff was that, and I think there was also pressure from the environmental community, that the walrus be killed instantly, that the effort be made to humanely take these marine mammals in a most efficient manner. And the walrus hunters were concerned, hey, you know, we normally don't use these big cavalry rifles for harvesting walrus because we have a method and means of how we harvest these walrus. We use small caliber rifle when the walrus are in the water so we can wound them and slow them down and then recover them. If we use high caliber rifles, that may kill the walrus instantly and it'll sink. And also, if we use high caliber rifles, you know, 7mm or 300 Magnum on a walrus, a lot of times the bullet will go right through that walrus and wound another walrus. And those were some of the things that they were concerned about. And the other one was enforcement. How is Fish and Game going to enforce the walrus hunters to make sure that they used only those higher caliber rifles to kill walrus? Are they going to board these boats and make sure that they have only those large caliber rifles? And the other concern was that most hunters do not go strictly out to hunt walrus. When they go hunting, they're looking for seals, they're looking for walrus, they're looking for ungroup, and not strictly for walrus, and therefore need these other smaller caliber rifles to hunt these marine mammals. And this suggestion that the sport hunters use these higher caliber rifles is, in fact, a reaction to that proposal that was put by Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Whether it was adopted, I don't know. Methods of harvest. There will be no indiscriminate firing into herds of walrus. There shall be no unnecessary harassment of walrus. Reporting and marketing or marking. The captain or hunter shall report all takes of walrus and other marine mammals to the Eskimo Walrus Commission representative. Staff will develop marine mammal calendar. And this is, I'm getting to the part that I was going to say earlier in regards to recreational hunting. Recreational hunting. Recreational hunting will be conducted in an adventurous and pioneering spirit using native guides and crew. All rules of Section 401 or 4.1 shall apply. That means in terms of the required equipment. The recreational hunter shall have one chance, one shot of harvesting the Pacific walrus. If the Pacific walrus is not brought down, then the backup native shooter will kill the animal for the hunter. And let me go back to history a little bit. Many of these professional hunters that came up to hunt the walrus in a lot of times did not know how to shoot the walrus to kill it.
Political problem, and not necessarily, I think, a legal problem. For example, I suspect that the federal government could pass a statute which either required or permitted, I'm not sure which, the state to manage certain species, all species, with a native exclusion or preference. And that, as I read the Supremacy Clause, and again, I haven't researched it, but the U.S. Constitution says that the legitimate laws of the federal government shall be superior to the laws of the states, anything to the contrary, nothing to the contrary withstanding in the state constitution. So I think that it would be possible for a federal law to overcome the state law, the state constitutional prohibition that focuses on race as a category and transform that into native people as a federally protected category. So it's not a legal problem, but the possibility of getting that kind of a law through Congress is a political problem. Now, that I think brings us back to, in my view, the Marine Mammal Protection Act and what happened there. There was a native exclusion in the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And the state argued at the time the walrus management was originally retroceded to it the exclusion did not go with it. In other words, and furthermore, the state couldn't manage the walrus with that native exception. But I think the state could, frankly, because that was what the law was interpreted to mean, was that the exception went with the retrocession. And the state could have, but politically it was unwilling to do that, in my view. And therefore, the Marine Mammal Protection Act was, I think it was therefore, it was amended in order to get over that political problem. But not, I don't think, really, to get over a legal problem, although that may have been the way it was characterized.
All right, Caleb, we'll give you the last word, just since you're not a lawyer, as far as I know.
I want to clarify a little bit what Dave just said about the amendments to the Act and how they affected the Native population. When state, in arguing its court before the judges on the Togia case, were saying that that Native exemption would, prevent their adequate management of marine mammals, or the walrus in this case. They also, their argument was that the Native exemption, when it turned over to the state management, was no longer applicable. But the Togiak people argued that the exclusion was total, that the act exempted Native populations from management. State could have continued management. They could have continued managing the walrus, provided that they recognized this Native exemption, and state was not willing to do that. And I think that's a very crucial point to be made, that they did not want to manage walrus with the Native exemption in provision in there. And the 81 amendments, the way the Act was amended in 81 was to remove that total exemption, and that the way the state would take management would be that rural residents could hunt the walrus. And there's a big difference. There's no longer this total Native exemption, but rather a rural resident requirement.
Thank you. Well, I think we'll move on now, having sorted out the question whether the exemption went with the retrocession. I thought that was a good phrase, and I wrote it down. I do appreciate what Larry and David have said. And well, Jim Kowalski, we have you down to tell us what initiatives are being taken by Tanana chiefs in relation to native management of subsistence, self-determination in the subsistence area.
Thank you. As I understood it, what you had asked for was roughly what you said. You stated it yesterday as, what are people doing to help themselves? And
all
I
right.
think that's
right.
That's just another way of putting it.
Let me
start by first stating the obvious, which is that I certainly do not in any way consider myself to be a expert in subsistence. I'm hired as a technician who deals with the system, so to speak. And in the program that we have at the Tanana Chiefs Conference, which is called Wildlife and Parks, the idea there is to give technical assistance to fish users of the resources and to village governments to help in any way that's possible to be sure that those users are directly involved in the system that allocates, that manages, and I might try to describe some of those things that we're doing. I should say, though, that the Tanana Chiefs Conference or region is the largest of the 12 regions in the state, otherwise known as the Doyon region. It includes all of the interior, and TCC is one of the 12 regional nonprofit native corporations. The region that we cover extends all the way from the Brooks Range, South Slope on the north, that would be as far north as Arctic Village, to to the Tok Northway area near the Canadian border to the south, and on the west near the starting to the lower end of the Yukon River Holy Cross, all the way up to Eagle on the Yukon-Alaska border. So we have a very large region, and because of that, the region is divided into six sub-regions. And so we have, just to explain to you how we function, we have a central staff in Fairbanks, and then we have six sub-regional offices with smaller staffs in six other locations throughout the region. We have a board of directors which consists of the 40 or so chiefs of the native governments of the interior, and then from those 40 there is an executive board which meets quite frequently, and then in addition to that, each sub-regional office has an advisory board, and so they set the program for us and tell us when we're doing right. And
Fish and Wildlife agencies. Well, why did they do that? Well, it was justified sometimes as a means of protecting the interests of native people, who in these jurisdictions usually constituted the majority of the trappers. But if one inspects the files of the Fish and Wildlife, the contemporary files back in those days of the Fish and Wildlife Services, you will find often that what they're really trying to do is protect the interest of white trappers who were coming into the country and wanted to make sure that they could make a living off these things without being interfered with by traditional trappers. And I think there was another factor at work there, and it was a widespread perception, which I think still prevails a lot as a philosophy in game management offices, and that is it was a means of overcoming the evils, the perceived evils of the common property system, whereby anybody could just go anywhere and trap as they pleased and not take care of the habitat and so on. And so what they perceived they were doing was implementing a system of private property rights, which would allow a better conservation of the resource. Considering the arrogance which typified game management in that era, not surprisingly, there was an assumption that there was in effect no system, traditional system, on which they were imposing this. In other words, there was no recognition that there was a whole traditional system of trap line tenure, if you like, in most of these areas, that was either based on families or extended kinship groups or whole villages or whatever it happened to be. So there was an assumption that we were just replacing a free-for-all with a private property system. Now, the other party that had some interest in seeing that system come in was the Department of Indian Affairs, who because again, if you look at the historical context in which this system came in, it was during a time when the trapping economy was declining very seriously because of low fur prices and so on, and in some cases was imposed in a situation where traditional harvesting practices had become quite disrupted by virtue of this economic problem, by virtue of epidemics and so on that had caused a considerable disruption in the traditional use patterns. Indian Affairs sought to protect the interest of the native trappers to a greater extent and tried, although the impetus for this came from the resource management agencies, Indian Affairs tended to try and speak on behalf of the local native populations to say, look, this is their economic base, you must make sure that they get some of these trap lines. And in fact, for the most part, they did. I would say that the chief disadvantages that Indian people perceived of the registered trap line system would have been three. One was that by making a private property institution out of what had generally perceived to be a collective property, community property, if you like, was that the trap lines became dissipated over time as individuals could be approached by white trappers and say, gee, I'd like to buy your trap line, I'd like to buy your trapping rights. And in some cases, if you look at the history of tenure over a period of 20 or 30 years from the 40s to the 60s or 70s, what you see is a gradual decline of Indian tenure in favor of non-native tenure of these trap lines. So in a sense, it's analogous to what happened to reserve lands in the United States that were given over to individual possession. Another is that, and this is quite commonly expressed, is that people felt that their traditional systems of running their trap lines were unduly interfered with by this system, because no longer could they operate the system of leaving some areas to rest and using others and going on this kind of rotation over very large areas on an extended family basis, that they had these smaller areas to which individuals they couldn't cross over to each other, they couldn't use each other's properties, or legally they couldn't, although covert.
The last several decades has been whenever there is an interest in terms of development, okay, there's been an interest in development comes in to our area, then they start looking at our subsistence resources. If it's going to be in the way, then studies are done to take care of subsistence resources. And a lot of the science ends up limiting our take allocations. And they forget one of the basic reasons why a lot of attention was brought to our areas was because of development. Look what happened in the North Slope. We have, impacts that they have had on caribou, the impacts that we have had been experiencing in terms of the bowhead whale. All of the research, most of it is diverted towards restricting take, and very little is done to protect the resource in terms of habitat. And I think we allude to it in all of our discussions here, but that's a major issue that we've been dealing with alongside the battle to protect our take.
Tom Lunner. Weaver, I understand that you now and together with your surrounding villages are discussing the form in which your own establishment of some more controls would take place. Are you anticipating that what will occur will both be control over land and over the taking of wild resources?
It's a little premature right now. I'm kind of hesitant to answer the question.
Okay.
But our interest right now is mainly the subsistence use of the resources and the subsistence use.
Thank you.
Jonathan Solomon.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. What my friend from Unit League is saying, through tribal governments, you know, we come into a situation right now where we talk about sovereignty, and if each one of us that are RAA consuls, our constitution was written by our fathers or our grandfathers a long time ago. And we recognize the land use of these areas as you see them on a map, on any rivers, they're exactly or close to 90 miles apart. And this is the way that our forefathers set it up. And we recognize the imaginary line for hunting and fishing between each village. That exists all the time. Like I said yesterday, that Doyon region, if you looked at the boundary of that region, and you look at the boundary of all the 12 region corporations within the state, them boundary lines were set many years ago by our forefathers. That's why when we came down to talking about the boundary line we didn't have not very much problem drawing the boundary lines and agreeing to it through the region corporations. These kind of boundary lines exist on any given Native area groups.